Sne. Welcome to Ekatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI.
Welcome back. Today, we're doing a deep dive into a really phenomenal piece of modern literature, Kieran Desai's 2006 Man Booker Prize winner, The Inheritance of Loss.
It's an incredible book.
It really is. And it's more than just a novel. It's this sweeping map of emotion and geography. This is the book that really cemented Desai's reputation as, you know, a major voice on global displacement.
It absolutely is. And what makes it so perfect for a deep dive is its ambition. Desai's writing has this lyrical density that captures both the beauty of the Himalayas and the brutal reality of globalization.
Right. It forces you to look closely at identity and dignity in a world that's constantly fracturing.
Exactly.
So our goal today is to really unpack the core question the novel poses. What is the inheritance passed down through generations that have been marked by, well, by loss and dislocation?
And we have these two narrative worlds, thousands of miles apart, but so intensely connected. We start in Kalimpong. It's a town on the edge of the Himalayas, always in the shadow of Mount Kanchenjunga.
And the atmosphere is just palpable.
Oh, completely. It's mist, decay, a deep melancholy. And the story is set in the mid-1980s. We meet this fragile little ecosystem of characters in a rundown colonial house called Cho Oyu.
A very memorable cast.
You have the retired judge, his teenage granddaughter, Sai, the fiercely loyal cook, and their dog, Mutt.
And their whole isolated world is about to be shattered. At the same time, though, we're following a parallel story in New York City.
Yeah, a really brutal, harrowing deconstruction of the immigrant dream.
So we're constantly shuttling between this political insurgency in the mountains and this economic rootlessness in the city. Let's start with the event that just blows up the peace in Kalimpong.
That moment is the inciting incident. It's sudden, it's violent. A group of young Nepali Indian insurgents, part of the Gorkhaland movement, they storm the house.
And they don't just rob them.
No, they humiliate the judge. And they steal his hunting rifles.
Which are so symbolic.
They're the last vestiges of the colonial power he has so desperately tried to embody his entire life.
Okay, let's unpack this a little, because the Gorkhaland movement isn't just background noise here, is it? It's really the engine of the plot.
It's crucial context, yeah. The movement was a demand by the Nepali-speaking Gorkha community for their own state. Mm-hmm. They argued, you know, that the Indian government had marginalized them.
Economically, culturally.
Right. So these insurgents, they see themselves as fighting for self-determination. When they seize those rifles, it's not just theft. They're dismantling the colonial echo the judge has worked so hard to keep alive.
Which brings us to Jamalbhai Patel, the judge himself. What a profoundly tragic figure. He is the living embodiment of colonialism's psychological damage.
He is. His whole life is a fortress.
A fortress, that's the perfect word. Built on isolation and this meticulous, almost grotesque adoption of Englishness.
And that's the core of his wound. To understand his cruelty now, you have to look at his past. The book gives us these devastating flashbacks to his time in England.
At Cambridge.
At Cambridge, yeah. He faced this profound, soul-destroying racial humiliation, and he internalized it. He learned to hate his own Indian identity.
So he spends his life trying to just erase it, performing this rigid, artificial English persona he thinks will finally earn him respect.
Of course, he's never truly accepted. So he brings that shame back home and, well, he weaponizes it.
It's hard not to feel for the young man he was, but that pain becomes the engine for all his cruelty later.
Exactly. And you see it most clearly in his treatment of his wife.
Yeah.
He just abandons her. He finds her too village, too Indian. His cruelty is isolation. It's all a construct built from that wound. It's a tragic cycle.
Yeah.
Humiliation is inherited, passed down like a disease.
And that pain trickles down to his orphan granddaughter, Sai. She's really the emotional center of the novel. If the judge is the past, she's sort of the present, trying to figure out her future.
She is so naive at the start, so sheltered. Her world is shaped more by Western books, by Austen and Bronte, than by the political reality just outside her door.
And her connection to that reality comes through her relationship with Gayan, her tutor.
Right, her Nepali tutor.
Yeah.
And their romance, it's so fragile and it blossoms against this stunning Himalayan backdrop. For a moment, you think maybe they can transcend all the differences, class, ethnicity.
But Desai makes it very clear that that idol is doomed.
Oh, yeah. Once the GNLF movement gains momentum, the strikes, the violence, the political atmosphere becomes toxic.
And this is where the personal becomes inescapably political. Gayan, he becomes so conflicted.
He does. He feels the weight of his community's grievances. He starts to see Sai not as the girl he loves, but as a symbol of the Indian elite. the class that oppressed his people.
It's just a heartbreaking demonstration of how these big impersonal forces can just erode personal decency.
Love just curdles into resentment, into shame.
And then comes the betrayal. He reveals the judge's location to his comrades.
And in that moment, Sai's innocence is just shattered. It exposes how precarious her position really is as this English-speaking outsider in a region that's fiercely asserting its own identity.
But the novel is brilliant because it doesn't just paint Guyan as a villain.
Not at all. He's a deeply tragic figure. You know, he's torn between his community and his affection for her.
Yeah.
Desai doesn't let you judge him easily. She makes you understand that for him, personal loyalty can feel like a betrayal of his people.
That complexity, that conflict between loyalty and identity, it's the perfect bridge to the parallel narrative. Let's shift focus to New York City, to Bijou, the cook's son.
A huge pivot in the novel.
It really is. We move from post-colonial trauma to the trauma of globalization. And Bijou's story is just, it's a brutal deconstruction of the immigrant dream.
He's an illegal immigrant. He's navigating this shadow world where dignity is just a luxury he can't afford. It's episodic, just moving from one awful exploitative job to the next.
Always in those squalid basement kitchens.
Always. And you see the exploitation, the racism he endures, even from other immigrants who are all just fighting for the bottom rung of the ladder.
So why is his loneliness so profound? I mean, he's in New York City, surrounded by millions of people.
It's the loneliness of being invisible. He exists only to serve, totally unseen by the wealthy world he feeds. His entire life is just survival, and it's all fueled by the pressure of his father's expectations back home.
Ah, the cook. His father is the novel's moral compass, really.
And his whole world revolves around this dream that Bijou is making a fortune in America. Bijou can't shatter that, so he lives a lie.
This is where Desai's critique of the quote-unquote borderless world really hits home. Capital flows freely, but people, especially poor people, do not. Bijou realizes he's a zero, a vacuum.
Yes. And the symbolism of food is so powerful here. In Kalimpong, the cook prepares meals with such care. It's a ritual, a connection to home. In New York, Bijou is in these kitchens where food is just factory produced and tasteless.
The degradation of the food mirrors the degradation of his own identity.
Exactly. He's physically feeding the American dream, but spiritually, he's starving.
This all builds toward the climax, where both worlds reach a breaking point almost at the same time. The siege in Kalimpong gets worse.
And Bijou hits rock bottom in New York. He's lost his job, his money, his passport, everything. His decision to go home isn't a triumphant return. It's a desperate, instinctual flight.
He arrives back a completely broken man, stripped of all the American illusions.
He hasn't achieved anything his father expected.
And the novel's conclusion, it offers no grand resolution, which is part of its power, I think. We're just left with this shared atmosphere of loss in an army-occupied town.
The brilliance is in its final, poignant act. Bijou finally reunites with his father. And the cook, he doesn't ask for explanations or money. He tenderly prepares a meal for his broken son.
It's a wordless moment.
Wordless and so profound. After the failure of the colonial dream, the American dream, the revolutionary dream, the novel seems to say that the only true inheritance that remains is that fundamental human connection, parental love.
So what does this all mean for the listener? Why does Desai refuse to give us that neat ending?
Because the struggles aren't over. The ambiguity is the point. It's realistic. Sai is left without Gan, Bijou is back where he started, and the judge is still in his fortress of shame. Historical forces don't just stop because a novel ends.
Let's talk about the craft for a minute. The novel demands empathy, and it achieves that masterfully through the third-person omniscient narrator.
Yes, the narrator doesn't just link the places. It dives deep into everyone's internal struggle. It forces us to understand the judge's cruelty, Guyan's anguish. It stops us from dismissing anyone as a simple villain.
You feel for everyone caught in these huge forces?
You do. And the language itself is almost a character, that constant mist over the mountains.
Becomes a crucial symbol.
Absolutely. The mist is moral and historical ambiguity. Nothing is clear. The true state of the house is masked by it. The moral choices are hazy. Desai is showing that simple answers just don't exist in a post-colonial world.
Ultimately, the novel is this profound meditation on home, and it asks us to consider why a stable sense of self is such a luxury in our interconnected yet fractured world.
The story really teaches us that the pressures of the global economy and the ghosts of history are inescapable. They crash into the most intimate parts of our lives.
Its enduring power lies in its ability to connect that grand geopolitical sweep to the quiet, heartbreaking struggles for dignity that define individual human hearts. It leaves you with a final thought. If dignity is the only thing we truly own, what does it cost to hold on to it when the world tries to strip it away? This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.